everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me today. This show is dedicated to empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And we all know how important it is to get truthful information. First of all, let me welcome people who have listened perhaps for the first time today. I invite you to go to my website, whatwomenmustknow.com. It's a great place to get lots of wonderful information. I do send out special reports if you opt in. This radio show also is sent to everyone in my community, so take advantage of the opportunity to get more education. And also my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, is a place to like. Go over there, like me at What Women Must Know, because I do daily postings of what I believe is important information that we must know. So you get some articles, you get some studies, sometimes some really interesting recipes. It's always educational, enlightening, and entertaining as well. So I hope you'll join me over there on my Facebook page. Now, today, our conversation is going to be a fascinating conversation. I actually encountered my guest today, Dorothy Mullen, at a wonderful conference I recently attended in New York City that was focused on, of all topics, air-centric dentistry, which is a pretty interesting topic, which I'll get into in the future, although I've had as previous guest Dr. Howie Hinden on, and he was talking about how important it is to understand the power of our airways. But today we're going to shift the focus. We're talking to Dorothy about a passion of hers, and we're going to be exploring how healing through the sharing of food is a profound experience for people. And I'd like to start off by reading a quote, a little passage in Dorothy's book called Logical Miracles that will set the stage for our conversation today. So here we go. So Dorothy started a program called the Suppers Program, and she will explain that in a minute. Suppers recognizes that food is our most expensive national addiction. In human and dollar calculations, the consequences of the processed, drug-like food supply already surpass the consequences of cigarettes and alcohol. Not only does processed food lead us down the path to obesity and diabetes, the havoc wrought on blood sugar and mood chemistry sets us up for dependence on and addiction to other substances. Experts disagree on which foods have what consequences, whether or not there are good foods and bad foods, or whether there are any nutritional advantage to organic or locally grown foods. Suppers recommends we not be part of their experiment. We know that eating food as it exists in nature is safe. For everything else, we are lab rats. And I think that really helps to explain the approach that Dorothy is taking. And let me just share a little bit about Dorothy and her background before we get into a very interesting conversation. Dorothy Mullen is the founder of the Suppers Programs, a network of nearly free-for-users programs in New Jersey that serves people who want to cook together, eat together, and prevent, manage, or reverse chronic illness through lifestyle changes. She is also a leader in the community gardening movement. The Suppers model slashes through tired assumptions and conventional wisdom about how to get healthy and prizes personal experimentation with food, exercise, and behavioral change. Her conviction that healing is a social experience led to a program design where people gather and try different styles of eating, vegan, paleo, macrobiotic, low carb, etc. In the safe and friendly settings of private homes and small public venues, people learn which foods make them feel stable, happy, and healthy. She has trained 50 volunteer facilitators, mostly women, who understand how crucial home food preparation is for healing and well-being. Dorothy has a master's degree in addictions counseling from the College of New Jersey. In her private practice, she uses addiction models to help people turn around entrenched eating behaviors that have placed them at risk for chronic health problems and addiction. And Dorothy is the author of a wonderful book called Logical Miracles. So it's with great delight that I welcome Dorothy to the show today. Hello, Dorothy.
Well, hello. What an introduction. Thank you.
Well, what a girl you are, Dorothy. You know, I have to say that you gave the lunchtime entertainment at the conference, which is not an easy act to pull off. And you were just so engaging and so inspiring that we just all loved you at this conference. So I thought my audience would love you as well. And I'm glad you're here. So thanks for making the time today.
Absolutely. Thank you. And that was a group of truly extraordinary dentists, orthodontists, and medical doctors at that conference, because they were looking very hard at their own professions and what their own professions had brought to the table in terms of pathological consequences to treatment. I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, it was very inspiring. And what you're going to be sharing us are the pathological consequences of our food culture. You know, yeah. I always talk about food wars that are going on. You know, the paleo people are attacking the vegan people,
right,
who have problems with the, you know, with the macrobiota. You know, it's just, it's like taboo subject in my seminars. I just tell people we're not going there because I don't want people to get into such an emotional uproar over which way is right, because there is no right way. There is only the right way for you.
For you,
and
right.
For you, right. And you have to find out what that is. And we've all been on our journeys of what that may be. There are lots of theories floating around out there, but what is our truth? And why don't you start by, I think maybe we should begin by explaining what the Suppers program is. And then I'd like you to talk about your background and how you arrived at this model.
Okay. Well, Suppers is a network now. It is a network of about 40 meetings per month, in mostly in central New Jersey. We're starting to move out a little bit. And it's all run by volunteer facilitators who have trained in this program. And it's really pretty simple. We gather people into our homes, usually around some particular point of interest. So people who are interested in paleo or eat to live or macrobiotic, they can form their own Suppers programs. Or people might have a diagnosis that's the sort of rallying point for wanting to get together and make this social experience out of eating and learning together. Type 1 diabetics, type 2 diabetics, people with celiac disease, colitis, you know, anything that requires very serious behavior change that is also difficult because it interrupts our addictive eating behaviors, we would form a meeting around that intention. And now, not to be all old people who are falling apart at the seams with chronic illness, we're also offering some meetings for young mothers that want to strategize how to get their children and particularly their husbands on board, because anytime you tell somebody that the quality of the food is going to improve, you know, you might not see the sodas anymore, and we're going to get rid of the sugar and start reading labels and sniff out all the high fructose corn syrup and everything, it's usually not greeted with, oh, yippee, mommy is going to start eating and serving healthy food. It's usually grousing and grumbling and, oh, brother, we don't want to make these changes. So there is strategizing on the spectrum from prevention to dealing with really very serious illnesses like rheumatoid arthritis, where people absolutely have to make changes to avoid their inflammatory foods, or they're just going to be shot up with steroids, you know, risk all the consequences, losing their hair, you know, having all kinds of immune system problems because of the medications. And what we're finding is that if you get well-intentioned people together and make the food delicious, so delicious that it rivals the addictive allure of the processed foods, which I'm sure your listening audience understands are designed to be addictive because that's how we sell more. If they can make alternate sources of pleasure out of the social experience, the smells, the colors, how lovely it is to have a group of friends working on the same problem together, then we can usually form a group that will actually be therapeutic, which will enable people to reduce their medications, in some cases even eliminate their medications. Definitely type 2 diabetes can be turned around. Definitely we can get people lower or even off medications for rheumatoid arthritis if and when they stick with the program long enough to find their personal, biologically individual solutions to what is inflaming for their personal bodies. And I can't emphasize that biological individuality strongly enough.
So this is a gathering that happens on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
Was it once a month or so that people
get
together?
Well, we have about 40 meetings a month in central New Jersey, and people can go to multiple different kinds of meetings. They could go four times a week if they wanted to, but each facilitator offers a specific theme. So the macrobiotic lady offers macrobiotic, and the type 1 diabetic lady offers insulin-dependent diabetes meetings, with it in mind that each facilitator is providing the kind of cooking and eating experience that is meant to tease out the solutions for the people who come to her meeting.
So you have these different meetings, and then people can go to those meetings and eat the food
mm-hmm.
that is the focus of that meeting.
Yes.
Or of that facilitator.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what's so interesting is, and what's so unique about your program is unique anyway, but it's about first of all, the need to eat healthy food. And secondly, it's the journey of listening to your own body, learning how to pay attention and experiment and explore with a variety of healthy eating, you know, models of what's going to best serve you on your healing journey, and mm-hmm. without judgment and without pushing any particular system on anyone. It's really the freedom to choose and find your own truth.
Yes, yes, and your own truth is revealed to you through these series of experiments that we do. I think there is so much entanglement with the processed foods that it's very much an untangling process. You know, a lot of people know, oh, well, I need to stop eating whatever, gluten or high fructose corn syrup, and for some people that's enough. But for many of us, we still have highly inflamed guts, or we still have the visceral fat that particularly postmenopausal women, it seems like an intractable problem. And so with this social support and this opportunity to try many different ways of eating, people are finding their way to personal solutions.
And we have to say, it's like you go and attend these events and you prepare your meal. So you it's not just sitting down and being served. You're in this process. Can you explain what goes on at these gatherings?
Sure. I'll describe to you what a meeting looks like. So the typical meeting would run for 2 hours. If you arrive at 11:30, you will sign in, wash your hands, deal with the money and the hygiene issues, and be given a job. Usually stations are set up around somebody's kitchen. And if you're a novice cook, you'll be assigned somebody to mentor you, maybe give you a little bit of knife skills lessons. And if you're relatively comfortable in the kitchen, then you can just start working at a station, washing vegetables, chopping vegetables, putting together a meat dish if it's meat being served. We often have probiotic fermenting parties, so there's often a head of cabbage on the table waiting for people to start the fermenting process. And over the course of 45 minutes or an hour, we'll welcome people as they come in the door, and there's all this great frivolity in the kitchen as we're cooking a meal together. It might be 8, 10, 15 at most people. And then by 12:20 or 12:30. People go into the dining room or wherever we're sitting down. We do a couple of minutes of a breathing exercise, some sort of a centering exercise to take us out of the chaos and activity of the kitchen and move our bodies and our minds into a more rest and digest mode. Then there's about 5 minutes of literature that calls us to our intentions. The underlying assumption of this program is that people need support to live according to their intentions instead of their impulses. So we have a few words about that. Then there is a roadmap to the food. As the food is being served, we'll talk about the rationale for including this. It might be, we wanted a lot of alkalinizing ingredients for a certain meal, and so we'll describe all of the alkalinizing ingredients in the food. If it's grass-fed beef like we had today, we'll talk about which farmer we got it from locally and why we are willing to pay more in order to have the local grass-fed. There's usually not dairy. There's never any gluten or sugar in these meetings. We talk about all the reasons why those things don't appear on the menu. And then we have our lunch, and it is choreographed by a facilitator whose job is to make it feel as much like normal lunchtime or dinnertime discourse as possible. But it's definitely facilitated. We don't have two or three conversations going on at once. There is an announced theme. Today it was how you feel is data, so that leads into talking about personal experiments, describing how we feel, connecting how we feel to what we ate or didn't eat. And then after about 45 minutes of that, we have our job cards, and people are asked to sweep the floor or wash a dish or help set the menu for the next meeting. And by 1:30, it's all done, and everybody goes home a little bit smarter and very well fed.
and nourished by the community.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So tell us how you created this program.
Oh, sure. Am I allowed to say bad things about the medical system?
Oh, we do it all the time
here. Oh, thank
you. Don't worry.
Yeah, I had a very bad experience that, of course, was transformative to me, and I will be forever grateful that I had this experience, but I would like to spare most people having that experience. It started for me. We had no idea why I had horrible digestive problems, infections all the time, lots of respiratory infections. At age 24, I was diagnosed as a universal allergy reactor, which meant every single thing that I was tested for, including the saline solution that was supposed to be the negative control, I had these skin responses to. I became in my 20s. I can't say I was an addictive personality, but I was drawn to coffee, drawn to cigarettes, drawn to booze, drawn to, you know, anything that changes how you feel quickly. And then by my early 30s, I went into a terrible postpartum depression and ended up in a psychiatric hospital, because when you have all of these things and the doctors can't diagnose and the psychologists and psychiatrists can't figure out what's wrong with you, if being depressed is part of the scenario, it's likely in this medical culture that that will become the diagnosis. So we put me away in a psychiatric hospital for a month, and I knew, because I had so many other medical problems, that the psychiatric part of it was just a piece of some greater problem that had not been diagnosed yet. So I remember weaving baskets and hopping like a bunny and doing whatever they told me to do and taking just horrible amounts of benzodiazepines and lithium it was, and blocking, I can't even remember. It's like 30 years ago since I had this laundry list of medications and put in a padded room when I had bad reactions to the medications. And after a month of this, I came out thinking, I know that I am sane. I am very ill, but I know that I'm a sane person. So that is where the seeds of passion to deal with the problem started. But I didn't get my solution until a decade or two later, when it was sorted out that what had happened to me was mercury poisoning. At the time that's why I was at this dental conference. At the time that I was 14, 15 years old, it was not unusual for a dentist to prophylactically put in a broad, shallow silver mercury amalgam filling into every single molar, so every single chewing surface in my mouth had one of these fillings in it. And, of course, for decades I was chewing on it and releasing the mercury vapors. And I was really very ill and mentally ill through my 30s and 40s until a friend of mine said, I think I want you to go to one of these doctors who deals with the autistic children, because you're showing a lot of the same signs as these kids who are very mercury toxic. And that turned out to be my answer. Well, by the time I finally got to my answer, I was so deep into alternative medicine and growing organic vegetables and helping to produce alternative medicine medical symposiums and focusing very much on nutrition and the quality of what I was eating, because that was the only thing that kept me sane and relatively well. And at that time, this is about 30 years ago, I did the Atkins diet, and while it was not the perfect match for me, it was good enough that I never had a panic attack again, nor a suicidal depression once I got on that way of eating. And that has since evolved to a lot more vegetables than meat, but that was the diet that brought me out of it. So the passion came from a lot of my own unnecessary suffering, and as I worked with Bob Atkins and Ron Hoffman and all these, you know, doctors in New York City who were doing this work really, really out on a limb 20 or 30 years ago, I realized that this is pretty usual. This is happening a lot. I remember Christiane Northrup, whom I'm sure you know well, getting up there and saying, we have created a nation of addicts. And I thought, that's exactly what we have created, because I can see how people are hooked on their way of eating. It's not just the obvious drugs and coffee and cigarettes. It's the food supply as well. So that's where the motivation came from, and I had become a good cook and an organic grower because I didn't have my own solutions. And I just at one point decided to parlay that into a nonprofit organization that would basically do for type 2 diabetics and people with chronic illness what AA does for recovering alcoholics. And that was to make it free to users. I thought, you know, anybody who has $125 an hour to spend on a registered dietitian or what have you, they can get this information. $1,000 for a cooking course, okay, that's fine. They can take care of themselves. I want to serve the people who don't know what they need, but know that it involves that they have to eat better and serve that population. So that's what I set out to do. I set out to create something that would be as nearly free to users as possible so that anybody could have access to this information.
And, you know, this idea, this concept that you initiated, you know, made into a nonprofit, is really growing and flourishing right now. I know that it's becoming really popular, and people from all over the country, even though you are right now only personally facilitating programs in New Jersey, mm-hmm. but this has become a program that people have a great deal of interest in all over the world, probably.
Yes, well, certainly the need is global. The question is, how can you make something that is so wedded to a location, a table, a real-life facilitator, you know, one mouthful at a time, one meal at a time? These changes involve incredible resistance. So, you know, short of the megachurches that are doing some very good work, to not only help people lose weight, but to help people tease out just what is it in the food supply that's driving their chronic inflammatory illnesses, it requires these small groups. I mean, let's put it this way. That's all I have been able to figure out so far. Intimacy counts. You know, the woman's touch counts. I don't want to take any woman's advanced degree away from her. I mean, I got an advanced degree, but to put women back in the workforce in large numbers without coming up with adequate substitutes for all of these lovely services that we've provided for our families throughout the millennia, really, it's just a formula for exactly what we have. Children in the midst of an addictive food supply, you know, being monitored and babysat by screens rather than parents, you know, a culture being raised by a culture of their peers instead of their parents. It's a problem, and I would just like to be a voice for honoring these wonderful services that women have provided for to their families for hundreds and thousands of years, and saying these things really matter. You know, I want to find the women in their 50s, 60s, and 70s who still know how to cook, because they have skills that we are just not nearly honoring enough in this culture. I want to find them. I want to turn them into facilitators. I want them to teach everybody that they know how to prepare food from scratch, and I want to help people understand and value how crucially important these skills are that we're losing. We so few people know how to cook properly anymore. It's very scary. Very scary.
Well, it's true. I mean, they're creating kitchens these days that don't have any ovens, stoves. They just
mm-hmm.
have microwaves.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where things are going. You know, you have a degree in addictions counseling,
mm-hmm.
and that's actually has shaped a lot of your approach and understanding with food. Can you talk a bit more about the addiction of food, what's happening for people, and you know, how we can heal those addictions?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes, it was only in the past 10 years that I got that degree. I had to make a decision about 15 years ago. Do I want to go back and get a degree in nutrition? And the answer that I came up with was, well, not really. We have lots of good nutrition science. The problem is people know what they're supposed to do, and they don't do it. And the answer to that problem lies more, for me, in the field of addictions counseling than in nutrition. So I decided to go back and get that degree at the College of New Jersey, and they were lovely with me. They read papers that they hadn't assigned, and they let me study nutrition and nutritional psychology, which was not part of the core curriculum by a long shot. And so I came away with two educations, the one that they wanted me to have and the one that they let me get, because they were willing to read everything that I wrote. So at that point, we were not yet having, you know, articles by Michael Pollan, and the New York Times magazine cover was not yet about the addictive nature of the food supply. That's much more usual now in the mainstream press. But at the time, I was looking at people's relationships with food and saying, okay, what is the definition of an addiction? Well, there are several. But the one that was most salient for me was that if you continue to do a behavior over and over again while knowing that it's harming you, that's one definition of addiction. So I'm looking around at the people that are having type 2 diabetes and people who have you know, obviously obesity is one of them, but also these chronic degenerative illnesses where they sedate themselves and comfort themselves with foods that are clearly not, they're not having kale smoothies for comfort foods. They're not going for the the sweet potatoes and the spinach and the salmon. They are comforting themselves on foods that I know are inflammatory, the baked goods and all the things that are loaded with sugars and gluten grains and so forth. So I focused my research on the addictive nature of the food supply. Then the former commissioner of the FDA, David Kessler, came along with a book called The End of Overeating. That was a bit of an expose. And, of course, the food manufacturers have known for decades that if they create these highly palatable foods that are designed by food scientists, and if they fill the halls of the malls with cinnamon smells or frying fat smells, that they're going to lure people in. If they get people accustomed to, you know, being triggered with golden arches or bottles of a certain size, shape, and color, it's all going to prompt people over and over and over again to go for the foods and the drinks that will keep them addicted and paying money for these foods and drinks. It's very, very lucrative suffering. So I thought, I'm going to take the exact opposite energy of this, well, I'll call it corporate greed that drives the addictive processed food supply. I'm going to take the opposite energy of that, and I am going to go out into the community, and I am going to find people who care about this problem and are willing to focus on supporting people unconditionally, just like they do for recovering alcoholics at AA, and not have a timetable, and not do a program that lasts 3 months or 6 months, and not do a program where you weigh in and then they give you bars and shakes to eat. I'm going to do just about the opposite of everything that I see that's highly profitable and do it more like the 12-step model. And that basis of assuming that addiction is at the heart of a lot of these chronic illnesses turned out to be a huge payoff, because now we're seeing people with rheumatoid arthritis who are able to either reduce or entirely get off their medications once they find the non-inflammatory foods for them, and 100% scrupulously avoid the foods that are inflammatory for them. And of course, without exception, it's the foods that operate on the dopamine pathways, like the high fructose corn syrup and the sugars, the morphine pathways, like the dairy foods and the gluten grains. They all, now we know, they all occupy the same receptor sites as these drugs. So if you start looking at your pizza, or your macaroni and cheese, and thinking, baby morphine, baby heroin, you start looking at your Snapple or your candy bars and think, this is like baby cocaine. It starts to crack people, well, I didn't mean to make a joke, but crack people open to the possibility that these foods are intentionally manipulated to feel like drugs, to change how people feel quickly, which is how they end up getting hooked on them.
So how does it work that, so people unknowingly, most people unknowingly have these addictions. They may even understand the theory, but don't really connect that their desire to have that macaroni and cheese or go for that pizza is actually an addictive urge.
Right.
It's, you know, that's driving their decision. How do they get to a place through your program where they get unhooked?
Okay, so there's always a point at which we scoop people up. For a lot of people, it's the vanity issue. I want to come and I want to lose weight. For some people, it's the pain issue. I'm in so much pain, I know I have some kind of inflammation in my body. I just can't take any more steroids. I'm looking for other options. They might end up at one of our meetings that way. We have doctors referring regularly now, so even if the sufferer doesn't get it, if he goes to a doctor that has anything like an awareness of gluten, sugar, and dairy effects on people, those doctors are starting to refer to the program. And, of course, the big one is word of mouth. You see your neighbor drop 20 pounds while you're eating luxuriantly on a very colorful diet, which, however, is missing a few of your favorite foods. But if you observe somebody suddenly on a bicycle, 20 pounds lighter, you know, lustrous hair, skin looking great, they want to know, I want what you have. How do I get what you have? So the word of mouth on suppers is very good. And once we get them in the door, then they're in the process where they learn about personal experiments. They are exposed on an almost daily basis to this concept that how you feel is data, that in the context of these meetings, we are going to teach people that the things that they are calling depression, anxiety, learning issues, fuzzy-headedness, confusion, impulse control problems, cravings. We are going to take all these things that people experience as feelings and sensations and help them interpret them so that they can tease out their moments of low blood sugar, so that they can get a sense if they're having a reaction to a food that they might have a sensitivity or an intolerance to, so that they can hear other people at this table talk about the difference made in their sleep patterns or their headaches when all they did was get enough water into them. This thing about dehydration, this is huge for some people. Chronic, long-standing problems with headaches evaporate for people for whom dehydration is the problem. When they start getting enough water, the problem goes away. A lot of it is pretty simple. But anyway, to answer the question, there are probably four or five different ways that people would end up on my doorstep.
Right. And so the program facilitates the experience of preparing. So you have a relationship with the food from the very beginning, and then there's education. And then you also said there's before you have the meal, you sit, you meditate, you just become more present and relax, which there's a whole movement of slow eating that mm-hmm. is happening now. Do you want to talk a little bit about how important it is to just kind of stop and be more aware, take a breath, and eat more slowly?
Yes. Well, I think the best sentence I ever heard was uttered by Jeff Bland, who's brilliant in functional medicine, and he said, "You are not what you eat. You are only what you absorb of what you eat." And as soon as you accept this concept that you're not what you eat, you are only what you absorb of what you eat, then you have to open yourself up to all of these other variables that are active in determining how well you absorb your food. So clearly, getting out of the fight and flight mode and into the rest and digest mode is an important part of it. Particularly people who are on the low blood sugar, high blood sugar, low blood sugar roller coaster, which now, Cheryl, you can probably give me the statistics on this, but I think it's like at least a third of Americans now who are on their way, you know, in at least in the early disease process that's heading them towards type 2 diabetes. Aren't the statistics something like that?
Oh, yeah, I think they're underrated.
Yeah, they probably are underrated. Well, you know, the brain is the most sensitive organ to poor nutrition. So long before you have heart disease or diabetes or, you know, problems with your joints, you're going to be feeling these vague symptoms around brain symptoms, fuzziness, fatigue is the number one, you know, poor concentration, particularly in women as we get a little bit older. It's just so easy to not be sharp anymore. And I want people looking at these diagnoses or these symptoms and saying, gee, I can probably fix this with a Snickers bar, or maybe that desire to have a Snickers bar is telling me that I am on this low blood sugar roller coaster. So we want people looking to their bodies to say, how I feel is data. What I'm feeling is not just random. It doesn't need to be a psychiatric diagnosis. I mean, maybe I do have that problem, but the more likely scenario is I need to eat well, I need to drink well, and I'm not sure if I answered your question, but that's what I just did with it.
Well, let's talk about food as data, feelings as data. You talk about that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think that's a core concept in your program.
Yes.
That you're trying to convey to people. So can you just elaborate a bit more about that?
Yes. So, well, food is definitely information. It's programming. It's something that you put into your body. It definitely affects all your hormone systems. Those are all chemical signaling systems. So anytime you put something into your body, now we're finding out that the things like kale, the alkalinizing vegetables, well, they're turning genes on and off, and some of them are pro-cancer and some of them are against cancer. And I think we're just at the beginning of all of these exciting ways, discovering the exciting ways in which food actually programs us. It programs us for health, addiction, all kinds of specific pathologies. But as, you know, just as a run-of-the-mill, everyday person eating food, we're not probably thinking about these things, but we are experiencing them. So our concept that how you feel is data takes your personal experience out of the realm of the mystery and puts it into the realm of intention. If I can journal my experience, if I can observe what I'm eating, how I'm feeling after I eat it, you know, how I feel differently if I'm eating when I'm relaxed versus if I'm eating when I'm at high tension or driving or, you know, otherwise upset and running adrenaline. If I can make observations about how I feel, both on the food and in the circumstances in which I eat the food, I will probably be able to sort out how to lose the weight, get off the SSRI antidepressants, maybe be less dependent on insulin or other, you know, metformin and the things that help stabilize the blood sugar pharmaceutically. I may be able to at least reduce the symptoms of the celiac disease. You still, obviously, with celiac, you have to live on a bit of a tightrope for that one. It's not as forgiving as some of the other things. But the point is that if you make your observations, if you take notes, if you share with candor at these meetings, if you journal the experience, you can unlock a lot of what seem like mysteries and experience what we call at Suppers the logical miracle. It is absolutely not a miracle at all to have your skin clear up, your brain fog go away, and your digestive pains evaporate. It's not a miracle at all. Once you get off the gluten, if you're gluten sensitive or you're a person with celiac disease, that's no miracle. It's just the logical conclusion of getting your needs met for good nutrition, and I always put social support in there too, that you need both good nutrition and social support. And even the less obvious diagnoses than celiac disease, we get the same results. If people accept that how they feel is data, they can plumb their bodies. They will find themselves endlessly fascinating as they do these experiments and learn to interpret the body's language and translate it into English.
Yes, that's so interesting. And so it's being made aware of that connection between what you put in your mouth and how it's impacting your body and your moods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, food affects us physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually.
Mm-hmm. It's not lucrative for the food industry, though, or the medical professions. I mean, it's a bit of a renegade solution.
It's kind of a blinding flash of the obvious, actually, because we need to really appreciate, and I think that we're becoming more aware, that the food that has become the traditional American diet is devoid of nutrition, is made of ingredients that actually make us all addicts. We are more of an addicted culture than I think people ever realized. When you understand that gluten is just as addictive, you know, as cocaine. When I remember one experiment where rats were given cocaine addicted rats were given the choice of cocaine or sugar.
Sugar water.
They would go for the sugar water.
Mm-hmm.
There were, you know, experiments where they would rather die than eat healthy food.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So,
that was right here in Princeton at the Department of Psychology. That's Bart Hobel's research. And he never did the research long enough to figure out how long it takes to be off sugar before you get over the hump where you don't have an even worse rebound reaction to sugar. This is what happens with the yo-yo dieters. They get off sugar for a while, and then when they get exposed to it, the compulsion to eat it is even worse than before they got off it. And the rat studies confirmed that, and it's, you know, it's taken a long time for mainstream to pick this up.
So can you give us maybe a couple of examples of what's happened to participants in your Suppers program?
Sure. Name me a disease category, and I'll take it from there. How about rheumatoid arthritis? Because we seem to be getting a lot of people with that.
Okay, we'll start there.
We'll start with that because it's so inflaming and it's so life-destroying. So we recently put it out there to our community that we were going to host two different kinds of cleanses this year. We would do Eat to Live, which is the Joel Fuhrman, no salt, no oil, all vegan, eat all you want, don't eat calories, but no gluten, no sugar, no processed foods of any kind. And then the other group decided to try paleo, which is, of course, a fair amount of meat, but it's still like 70% vegan, no sugar, no gluten, no processed foods, and then you have some meat with it. So from the point of view of the vegans and the omnivores, it was two very different cleanses, but really they were both extremely clean diets that didn't have gluten, sugar, or dairy in them. So there were
or any processed food.
And nor any processed foods, not one speck for the 30 days that we did the cleanse. Well, in both groups, we attracted people with rheumatoid arthritis. And people must have some sort of an inner voice that tells them, oh, I'd be better on the vegan one, or oh, I'd be better on the paleo one, because they chose correctly. And we had people in both groups whose inflammation went way down, who reduced the requirements for medication, and whose doctors were asking them, what are you doing that you don't need all of these medications anymore? Now, these cleanses obviously were not by diagnosis. So in the cleanses, we had people with other diagnoses. One fellow with celiac disease, his skin has cleaned up. His digestion has cleaned up. He experienced, now I'm not all that familiar with the neurological complications associated with celiac disease, but he had experienced a lot of brain fog and fuzzy thinking and mental fatigue. That all cleared up just doing paleo. So he's way down on the medications. We tend to attract a lot of people who have either insulin-dependent type 1, insulin-dependent type 2 diabetes, or who are trying to avoid becoming insulin-dependent. And, of course, the paleo diet also happens to be a very low-carbohydrate diet. So people did very well on that in terms of more energy, losing weight, reducing their dependence on the diabetes medications. But then we also had a vegan who's, I'm going to say she is the poster child for the African-American woman who's obese, diabetic, didn't pay attention to the doctor, landed in the emergency room, and was dosed up with just huge, multiple kinds of insulin and medications. And she decided to do the vegan route, and she went down two-thirds of her insulin, four dress sizes, and 40 pounds. And then she had to fire a doctor and a pharmaceutical company because they kept on coming back to her saying, well, why aren't you filling your prescription? And she said, you don't understand. My A1C is better now on less medication, but apparently they haven't heard this enough. So they didn't know what to do with her. They just kept on sending her notices that she needed to refill her prescriptions. So obviously there's a lot of resistance from the medical community, except among the doctors who are open to these possibilities. So those are just examples of the disease categories that can be helped by this. I will mention the biggest unintended benefit of working the SUPPRS programs is these people who had no idea that their SSRI antidepressants were related to their food, and when they get all of these other benefits like weight loss and better blood sugar control, they're finding that they just don't need as much or maybe any of their antidepressants anymore.
Striking. You know, it must be such a revelation for these people to get this profound relationship between
it's
what
awesome.
They've been eating and what they've created in their bodies. Because they've never been told, or even if they have been told, they haven't had the direct experience of seeing what's possible. You know, I think your your programs are, you know, working on many, many levels or many dimensions to what you're offering for healing. And one of them, it seems to me, would be the social support side of your programs. Do you want to talk just a little bit about the importance of social support and community?
Yes, absolutely. It's huge. The first principle of our program is not whole food preparation. The first principle of our program, and we expect people to work this, is the active practice of non-judgment. So when people come to these meetings, initially they may be a little bit surprised to see how much we do to help people out of their self-brutalizing ways and their judgmental ways that make it very difficult to interact with others in a socially supportive, loving, kind, gentle way. I think maybe some of it has to do with so many of our people have eaten their way into a bad diagnosis. They're filled with shame. And so we have to spend a lot of time undoing that shame and guilt and the sort of brutal social habits that come out of that, criticism and judgment and so forth. Once we do that, we have created this lovely therapeutic environment where people slow down. Only one person is allowed to talk at a time. Everybody else's job is to listen generously while one person speaks at a time. And then through these mutual experiences, we set up what we call therapeutic friendships in a 12-step program. They would call it sponsorship, but in suppers we call it therapeutic friendships, so that if people, let me give you an example, if people are going to go to a wedding or a bat mitzvah and they know they're going to be confronted with this groaning board filled with all kinds of favorite foods that they absolutely cannot eat and feel well the next day, they could seek the help of one of their therapeutic friends and say, would you bookend this experience for me by calling me at 7 p.m. on Tuesday night and again at 11 p.m. on Tuesday night so that I can get through this experiencing knowing that you are with me while I'm at this smorgasbord. And just knowing that there is this presence of a loving therapeutic friend while you're at whatever the social event is that's very challenging in terms of food helps people get through the experience without eating abusively.
And I recently interviewed Dr. Michael Roizen, who is Dr. Oz's sidekick, and he is the head of the Wellness Center at the Cleveland Clinic, which has gone through quite a transformation in the health of their employees because they're employing his model. And one of the things he has people do is doing a lot of walking. He goes for 10,000 steps a day. But the second most important principle of his program, he said, was social support. You've got to go find a friend and do it with a friend. And this whole understanding of the power of community and of social support and encouragement is a critical component of success for your, you know, for anything, but we're talking in this realm of health. And I can really see where that would just be such a powerful piece of the puzzle that you're addressing and putting all those pieces together.
It's enormous. Can I give you an example of this? Do you have a minute for an example?
Yes.
So we for whatever reason, we have a lot of groups of middle-aged Jewish women who are diabetic. I'm not quite sure why that's true, whether they're more willing to seek the help or if they have the diagnosis more. I am not sure. But this is why we must never, ever judge. We had a woman in the program, a terrible A1C, probably 9 or 10, something like that, a very bad, a high number for a type 2 diabetic. And nobody in her family, she was the daughter of Holocaust survivors, nobody in her family knew that she was diabetic. She had no idea if anybody else in her family was diabetic, but they were all very large people, clearly disordered eating. And she kept on coming back to meetings and kept on coming back to meetings, and she ate well when she was at meetings, but she did not do any changes the other 6 days of the week. And then one day it came out that she had never told anybody anywhere except in those four walls in my dining room that she had type 2 diabetes. And I thought, how arrogant of me to think that I was supposed to help this woman fix her type 2 diabetes when what was really much more important to her was that she was listened to, that she found one place on the earth where it was safe enough for her to share that she had this diagnosis that was so shameful to her that she couldn't even talk to any of her family members about it. That was a real clincher for me, that we shouldn't make any other assumptions about what healing means to another person, because it might be that social support, those loving ears, were more important to her than reversing her type 2 diabetes.
And I actually think that a place of unconditional love is a vital piece of the healing puzzle for all of us, whatever we're healing from, just to be heard and respected and honored for who we are. So this is such an exciting program. I know that you have gotten a tremendous amount of interest. Your success speaks for itself. You have written a book called Logical Miracles, which talks about your program and explains, you know, stories, what facilitators need to do. So I would imagine if people want to know more, they can go to thesuppersprogram.org. Is that what you would recommend, Dorothy?
Yes, it's thesuppers with an S, programs with an S, .org. And if you send an email to that address, it will come to me. If you contact us, it will come to me. And I would just like to say that for people who are not within an hour or two of Princeton, New Jersey, I have, in anticipation of the show, created a document called Where There Are No Suppers, which I am happy to send as a link, because what I am doing is not rocket science, but neither can it go viral. It depends on finding the person who loves to cook and is willing to help others share what she knows, and I can help provide some direction for people who want to do that.
Well, I trust our conversation today has inspired a lot of people to want to be part of this grassroots healing movement of getting back to blinding flash of the obvious.
Blinding flash of, I love that. I'm going to steal that sentence. I love it.
Yeah, you can feel free. You know? So this has been such a great conversation. I want to thank my guest today, Dorothy Mullen, for creating the suppersprograms.org. Go check it out. It is it's a place where we can heal and support each other and enjoy delicious food on the wave as well. So, Dorothy, thank you so much for being with us today.
It was a great honor and a pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.